Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm Mira. We are associated members of ML4Q.
And you're listening to ML4Q&A, a show where members from the Matter and Light for Quantum Computing cluster talk about their careers, their research, and the future of quantum.
We're excited to have ML4Q professor Mario Berta on the podcast today. Chris, ever thought whether you want to work in academia or big tech?
Phew, I'm a very senior postdoc by now, so I absolutely have. But Mario actually joined RWTH Aachen at the end of 2022, coming from Amazon Web Services in California.
Well, maybe ML4Q's academic excellence makes up for the weather and money. I was quite surprised to learn that he almost didn't go for a PhD.
We will talk with him about that and about quantum algorithms, benchmarking them, and what it takes to bridge the gap between theory and industry. But also about starting a research group, teaching theoretical physics, and the saga of the quantum version of Stein's lemma.
So let's jump in and hear from Mario himself about his fascinating path through academia, industry, and back again.
Mario Berta, welcome to the ML4 Q&A podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We wanted to start a bit with your background, and obviously you are from Switzerland, which many people will find cute. Is Swiss German your native language?
Yes, it is.
And would a German person understand you, or did you try?
Generic German people not, I think, but at DTH there are also lots of Germans. My PhD advisor is also like, high German was his first language, so he would adapt and then learn, and so it's possible.
So we wanted to give people a very quick sample. So could you just say the Feynman quote, "Nature isn't classical, damn it," and if you want to make a simulation of nature, you'd better make it quantum mechanical in Swiss German?
Okay, let me think about it. Natur ist nicht klassisch. Verdammt nochmal. Wenn man sie will simulieren, dann sollte man das mit quantenmechanischen Methoden machen.
Ja, okay.
Is that good enough?
Yeah, fairly understandable for a German like me.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. This is the Zurich accent kind of, so there are different flavors, of course.
As a student, were you already mathematically oriented? Was mathematics your favorite subject or physics?
It was kind of mixed, so I should maybe say that my father was like a high school physics teacher, so I had a lot of exposure there. And then when it came to university, I was thinking about either math, physics, or computer science, basically. Okay. I was never very talented, in a lab or like this kind of experimental thing. So then you kind of naturally gravitate towards math, I guess, yeah.
So people usually say, don't worry about the foundations of quantum mechanics until you're well established. But you did your diploma thesis in the lab of Renato Renna, who's kind of known for also, among other things, this foundation of quantum mechanics. So did you go into this lab more on the foundational level or more on the mathematical level? What got you into this?
When I graduated at DTH at the time, Renato wasn't there yet. So he was just about to start. I was still in Cambridge postdoc. So I emailed him. I knew he would be coming. And then I started my thesis the same day he started there, actually, which was very nice. I guess I was interested in different areas of physics, also at very large scales, general relativity, cosmology, and things like that. But the reason I went into quantum is because I thought there's the most happening there. There's the most new science, it's kind of a dynamical area, and that spoke to me, as so to speak. I don't think I had a very good idea of we can do more mathematical stuff, we can do more foundational stuff. I just heard quantum mechanics 1 and 2, and then I went into it, yeah.
Master thesis is quite compact, and mathematics can be a very compact language. So did you on purpose try to keep it that way?
Well, it's very short time only at ETH. I don't remember even 4 or 6 months compared to 1 year in Germany. So that's one reason maybe it's shorter. I have to recall now, but I think basically we had, like, there were some results, but like the full results, it was only like done very late. Okay. So there was just also not a lot of time to write this up in some sense. I mean, generally, if you can say what you want to say in a certain number of words or pages, I think one shouldn't like stretch it. So I would probably do it the same way again. Yeah.
So, and there's a little break between your master thesis and the start of your PhD. Can you tell us about this whole story? Yes.
I found it a bit like too difficult, too hard to do science after my diploma thesis back then. You have to think very hard, right? Like progress is slow. Like, of course, it can be very rewarding. I basically decided not to do a PhD and went into like finance in Switzerland. I didn't like that at all. I'm like, okay, maybe I should stick with science and maybe see where it goes, you know, put a bit of effort into it. And I really liked the type of work and kind of working conditions. So I didn't look back.
And then you did your PhD with Matthijs Christanden. So, and whose PhD supervisor was Arthur Eckert. So the acknowledgement of your PhD thesis read like a who's who of mathematically oriented quantum information scientists. How was it to grow into this community?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I also have to like credit Matthijs for that, because he really introduced me very early on to everyone. There was lots of travel funding available, and I also really like the social aspect of this, and I like to travel, meet people. So this actually, I would say, part of the reason I'm in science. You know, these kind of interactions.
And it's this community, it's really a sub-community of the quantum information community. Would you agree that, like, there's sort of the broad high-P quantum information ecosystem, but there's also this core of mathematical physicists?
Yes. I mean, of course, the whole area grew a lot. Like, they're still growing every year, like, a lot. But I think, like, I don't know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, like the way it started, this is this kind of like core quantum information theory, which started from a lot of mathematical principles also. And I think, yeah, that community, this quantum information community, this is what it is nowadays, kind of this core community. There's also this quantum information processing, which is kind of the most important annual event. Which is kind of assembled around that community to a certain degree, at least. But of course, yeah, these days there are lots of other communities. There's all the computational things. There's industry. Like, indeed, now it's actually quite a small and also a bit older community in some sense.
So, given all that background, we also were trying to understand what is the border between mathematics, computer science, and physics. So, do you consider this very mathematical study of quantum mechanics still physics, or is it a branch of mathematics?
Yes, of course, there's a lot one could say about that. But like my principle is kind of that it's really an interdisciplinary area. And I think also if you live it that way, it's, you know, it's most productive. So, for example, it was postdoc at Caltech. There's this Institute for Quantum Information and Matter. And this is really between departments, between faculties. And maybe if you're a professor, it's a bit different. But if you're like PhD student or postdocs, you don't even know what department people are coming from. Yeah. And this is like super, super nice. You can have discussions. It's really like emerging of ideas. This is a big reason why our area was or still is very successful, yeah. And I think we should do more of that in Germany also. I'm trying to do that a bit in Aachen with the computer science department, but there are lots of barriers, let's say, because just kind of the organizational structure of the university. But anyway, we're working on it. And now, having said all of that, I mean, I'm not finding new physics. Maybe I should put it that way, right? In that sense, it's math, right? Mm-hmm. I work with the whatever the mathematical framework of quantum mechanics. I show maybe new things in there, but this typically doesn't lead to new physics, which is also sometimes challenging if you're like at a grand interview or some physics panel, right?
Yeah.
Like,
you know.
So maybe that's a distinction. And then, I think related to the question, like mathematical physics, for example, is this at the math or the physics department? I don't know. It depends on the country, actually. So yeah, it's somewhere there.
You also have a lot of students which have background in computer science, right?
Computer science and even like electrical engineering.
What do you think of this year's Nobel Prize? Do you think it was justifiably awarded to the category?
Yeah, we should say it's the neural networks, Hinton model.
Yes.
Is this physics or is this computer science or even mathematics?
The thing is with the Nobel Prize, right? Like there's only one in physics. There's none in computer science. There's none in mathematics. And then the Nobel Prize kind of stands out amongst all prizes in science or engineering or whatever, right? So it's kind of like this like black and white type of thing, which maybe is not the best thing ever. but still, no, I think this is perfectly justified. Like if you look at the criteria for a Nobel Prize, in my opinion, and maybe some computer scientists are a bit like offended. I don't know. but I mean, physics is also really heading in that direction, like if we like it or not, I think. Yeah.
So you work in this strongly mathematically rigorous, but there's, you know, very many different tasks in this broad quantum field. And I guess it's very different to work on optimizing a concrete algorithm than to try to prove bounds on, you know, more broad tasks. Like, I mean, quantum hypothesis testing, which you have worked on, for example, is to me seems like a very broad thing where you can prove bounds. And then there's, you know, concrete algorithms. Where do you fall on this spectrum of, and what do you prefer?
So interestingly, I think at the moment I'm kind of doing a bit of both in some sense. So originally, indeed, I was working more on like core quantum information theory, a lot of mathematical conceptual questions, and I still do that. Like my ERC grant is also for that type of topic. But then, since I also worked in industry for a couple of years there, I picked up working on quantum algorithms, and I think there, you can also make like kind of broad statements or propose kind of some meta algorithm and try to like argue about how the performance. But it's indeed true that then in the end, like if you want to really like solve problems, concrete problems of interest, you need to dive into much more details and tune different type of things. And we do that also in collaboration with other groups or with industry. And I think in that sense, I'm also involved on that front. Like my personal preferences, I still like to do core quantum information theory a little bit better, maybe, because it's cleaner. It's kind of more slick or beautiful in my opinion, right? Because if you have to, if you have to write an algorithm, really run it end to end, there's a lot of not so clean stuff. You just have to like fine tune it, you have to massage it and so,
Yeah, especially with error correction, right? Like it seems that thinking quantum algorithms and quantum error correction together is also probably important, and there's many tricks.
So error correction would even be like on like an additional kind of direction. And of course, if you're serious about doing stuff on quantum computers, you have to ultimately combine all of these things and also kind of mutually optimize these things. I agree. I think, for example, in this like Google Quantum AI team, they do a lot of that where they think about both sides. I usually don't think about error correction myself. And the reason being that you kind of, if you want to like optimize your algorithm for your error correction architecture, you need to have kind of some concrete systems, some concrete hardware in mind. And I don't have access to any of that. Like this is, for example, different from the Google lab, right, where they have an experimental and a theory team. And then, so that's why I would talk about algorithms usually independent kind of the error correction overhead.
So you're more still on the pen and paper side or mathematical?
Yes. I mean, usually what we do is if you propose an algorithm and then you try to prove kind of rigorous worst case performance guarantees, which tell like, okay, whatever problem, you know, you throw at it, it, you know, it will solve it with that type of complexity, with that type of runtime, that type of scaling. But then, of course, you also want to test it on like typical instances of the problem that you're interested in. And maybe you want to kind of make heuristic arguments why it would perform well. So this is also part of the work. I think you want to do both, because ultimately what you actually want to do is to try out the algorithm on real computers, real quantum computers, in the same way we do this for classical algorithms, right? But we can't do that. So we need to kind of approach it from as many sides as possible.
So are we getting better at understanding the potentials and the limits of quantum information processing?
Yeah, I think we're getting better in the sense that we know better where the advantages might be and where they're not. I don't know this where they're not, if this is getting better. Like, okay, we have a better understanding, but it's not necessarily only positive, right? In the sense that, you know, some areas where we might have believed that quantum is good, maybe it's not as good as we thought. But actually, yeah. So interestingly, like the original algorithms was kind of in the 90s maybe, and then for a long time there wasn't that much progress. But now, maybe let's say in the last 10 years, there was a lot of progress again, and I think it's partly fueled by industry also. Mm. So yeah, that's very nice to see. Yeah.
Do you think, like, I mean, of course you come from this more mathematical side, but do you think people just playing around with quantum computers are going to stumble into things?
Well, I think if we would have quantum computers that, you know, are
better,
let's say, that, you know, actually allow for a decent number of steps of computation and stuff, then yes, indeed. I think this also, you know, in let's say classical theoretical computer science, you know, people propose algorithms, they look at runtimes, and then later people implement them for their problems, they test them, they fine-tune them. There's even like decades of experience of like how you do these things, and then in the end, you know, you have like products, you have software that people use in the industry, right? So we would want to have the same chain in quantum. But okay, so if you work with nowadays quantum computers, it's sometimes much more difficult, right? Because basically what you're arguing is kind of, what you're seeing is noise. So you kind of can argue about like noise tolerance maybe and stuff like that, but not really about like the core working of the algorithm, in my opinion.
So after your PhD, you did postdocs as well, or a postdoc. You worked at Caltech with John Preskill, and that's very much at the center of the quantum hype, also close to the Silicon Valley. So how was this experience?
I mean, it was awesome for me. I mean, I was really excited, you know, to go to California and, you know, LA, have a good time also, like more broadly. But I really, IQM is, I really loved the time there. As I think I already mentioned, right, it is this very interdisciplinary place. And other things I really liked about it, like I had this complete academic freedom. I think I was there nearly 4 years. And there was not a single thing I had to do, not a single meeting I had to attend, like really had to. Just like, you know, lots of fun, do whatever you want, go wherever you want, right? And this is how, you know, good new science comes into existence, I think, and should have more places like that also in Europe, I think. That would
asking,
be nice.
I'm asking for the German postdoc community.
Yes.
How much teaching did you have to do there?
None.
Okay.
I rest my case.
No, this is not, but again, right, like 4 years, not a single thing I had to do, right? Yeah. This is very interesting. Of course, okay, it's a competitive place, right? You have to get into it, but so that was really nice. The other thing that is great is that basically, because it's such a well-known place, all the people that have good results, they basically pass through there. You know, they go there, they present the results, so you have access. You're like in the middle of things. Exactly. So the thing that was more difficult at first is that everyone's very smart, right? So you realize, like, you know, where you stand and where you don't stand. So this is something you have to like cope with,
yeah.
I guess. But you can take a lot of positives from that, I think. Yeah.
But was it still with the idea that you wanted to stay in academia at that point?
No, actually not. My plan was then to go indeed to Silicon Valley and, you know, take a job at Google or whatever. I mean, back then it wasn't so much of a thing that, you know, you would work in the quantum industry. I mean, there were some teams, but like it wasn't really like a viable like career option per se. No, I thought I would actually, even my postdoc, I just applied to a couple of schools. I'm like, okay, if this works out, if I can go to a place, I'll continue. You know, it's fun. Because I think on paper, like being an academic, it's kind of it's a very risky kind of adventure. And it's you don't make your life easy, right, in some sense. Whereas if you go work for a tech company, you know.
I mean, worst case, you earn a lot of money.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So don't know. The answer is is no, I this was not necessarily the plan, but I also didn't exclude it. Yeah.
Did you get an injection of this tech bro optimism there, or
the tech bro optimism? No, but just kind of, let's say, the California optimism. It feels very different. Of course, the institute is very like international, but just life generally, yeah, it's a bit more optimistic. I guess Europeans say it's superficial, but you know. Now we're just superficially not optimistic. Like it's the same way, right? Like we're equally superficial, but not. That's my take on it anyway.
Then you joined Amazon, AWS. What was it like working for AWS?
Yes, I should say that I first, I went to London also, right? To Imperial College. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that's not so important, but for me personally, it was important because I was there. Was faculty there in the computer science department actually.
Okay.
And it's basically, you know, with what they pay, you can't pay rent. So I, you know, Imperial College is like a really good school, like grading wise, and also there are really good people there. But then I complained, you know, head of department, and they're like, oh, you know, we expect you to also do some consultancy, to work in industry, kind of like that was, because that's also good for your research anyway, and we won't pay you more, but you know, we'll approve whatever. And so that's how I started working in the quantum industry, actually, Cambridge Quantum Computing back then in London. Yeah. And that's when I realized that the industry is actually doing very interesting work as well. And there can be lots of fun, indeed. And then after I was 3 years in London, I was made permanent, kind of. And that meant I could, you know, also take, I don't know, I might call it a sabbatical or just like a year somewhere else. So that's when I said, okay, I want to try out industry more. And then, okay, I had lots of connections with this Amazon Web Services quantum computing team. And that's how I got into it. It was very difficult because there was COVID also at the time. So it was very non-trivial to arrange things.
Just briefly, Cambridge Quantum Computing is now
Quantinuum. Yes,
exactly. They merged. Maybe might even not have heard it anymore because they merged with...
Actually,
Honeywell, maybe?
I think it was Honeywell, maybe? Yeah.
But now it's one of the big players.
Actually, I'm trying to work for them again, but in Germany, it's a bit more difficult to do like part-time consultancy stuff when you're like a professor. There are lots of legal things that have to be sorted, but you know, I'm in the process, let's say. Anyway, so then Amazon, right? Well, so for me, it was a bit of a shift of topic, right? As I briefly mentioned before. So there was a couple of months where I had to get accustomed to things. So I will say I had much more time for research there versus in academia as a professor. So in that sense, I really enjoyed it. Of course, it's less kind of personal. Like I had a lot of freedom also to explore things. But in the end, you know, there's some line manager that tells you like, okay, we stop doing this now, we do that. So that's... these are the two biggest differences for me compared to academia. One is you have more time for research in industry if you have like a really like a top-notch job as a scientist in the industry. But of course, there are political things that can happen and then, you know, you have to adapt.
I mean, AWS on the one hand is developing quantum computers in-house, but they're also sort of already one of the main cloud providers for quantum computing. Do you think that, do they win either way? Do they have to have their in-house solution win? Or is it like, will they sort of be okay in any case?
I mean, Amazon is going to be okay in any case.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Yeah, sure.
So even if you, you know, you spend $1 billion on this a year, exactly.
Even
it's like a couple of percentages
yeah.
at most from their research and development yeah. budget. So in that sense, it's just kind of like a high-risk fund type of project. But it has significant size indeed. And there, as you say, there are different aspects to it, right? There is kind of the actual research team that also builds a quantum computer. There's the whole cloud management. And then there's also a third team which does like customer projects and kind of consulting solutions lab. So I don't know. I haven't been there now for a while. I will say though that this is a very non-typical project for Amazon, right? Because you have other companies like, let's say, Microsoft or IBM or also Google to a certain degree. They have this kind of track record of doing kind of basic research and just see where things land. You have this kind of research lab. Yeah. Amazon did not have that. They were always like, they're very like product or customer oriented company. So it's a bit of a new thing. So I'm not sure where it will lead eventually. Yeah, it's a good question.
But I mean, they even hired people like you who are more on the very theoretical side, I think, right? So they...
Yes. I mean, hiring decisions, of course, are also made based on, you know, who you know already in practice, right? So maybe they would have liked my profile a bit better if I would have been a bit more applied, but, you know, they knew like I could do good work, like we could work together and stuff. Yes, but I think there's still a difference on kind of how the whole project is set up. I mean, without wanting to talk too much about like, you know, company politics, but there's really the idea that, okay, we have a product, this cloud access to a computer, this is, sell this to customers, right? Pay for it. That's one thing. And then, I mean, also with the in-house quantum computer, the idea is to put that in the cloud and sell access, right? This is the main motivation, I think, yeah, for them.
One of the things with quantum computing is that there's technically blind cloud computing, even for classical tasks to some extent. Do you think that will be a viable business?
Well, okay, so you can do the same actually also classical cloud computing, right? You can ask, okay, so I'm a cloud provider. I want to provide, you know, services where people, you know, they don't want us to know what are the algorithms that we perform and stuff. And the problem with that is there is just like a huge overhead in terms of like inefficiency if you want to run computations like that. And so that's why, at least in the classical world, this is more of a niche business, let's say. And I'm not sure why they should be different in a quantum setting, like long term. I'm not sure if what computations are so kind of for which it would be so important that the cloud provider wouldn't know. I mean, people
that
usually think very
to
little.
Sign a contract. Yeah.
Yes, and people think very shockingly little about security online generally, I think.
And I mean, so, maybe the people that have such a deep security requirement usually also have the money to buy something and put it on premises.
Yes, that is true. I mean, sometimes it's a nice area because it kind of, it's at the intersection of cryptography and computing, and everything cryptography in the quantum realm is a bit more near term. So that's why this is maybe, you know, developed a bit more and talked about a bit more about this. But long term, I would still like to see an argument why in the quantum regime, whatever, it's more important to have private computations versus in the classical regime, where it's at most a niche business. But,
yeah.
What kind of applications does the research that is more theory or mathematically driven have in the industrial setting?
Well, this is a long-term game, right? Kind of. In some sense, right? Like information theory kind of started in the modern sense with Shannon, right? Claude Shannon in the 40s and 50s. And this was a very, like, first time, like a kind of a mathematical approach to information processing. And I don't know what people would have answered back then if you would have asked this question. But in some sense, right, like we're now working on kind of the same type of like a quantum version of what Shannon did for information processing, trying to understand the quantum concepts there and how they're different from classical or not different. And so in that sense, I think I'm confident that, you know, that there's clear, like, long-term impact. But otherwise, I think the theory impact is maybe, well, on the one hand, for error correction, I think, you know, people come up with like better codes. You know, there are lots of classical coding theorists, you know, that,
yeah,
I don't know, even like 4G, 5G mobile code and stuff, right? Like, these kind of expertise is now coming more into the quantum error correction regime. And so I think there you usually start very mathematical, and then, but then it can be applied quite fast. So error correction, I think, would be one. And of course, algorithms, right? Like Shor's algorithm was like a kind of pure math paper originally. And so there is that pipeline, if you want. But yeah, it's very indirect. And of course, these examples are also kind of very post-selected now, right? There were lots of ideas, and lots of them were maybe they were useful, but not for applications. And now we see a few that survived. And
I think both Shor and Shannon might have been on company payrolls while they did these discoveries, right? Certainly Shor was working for IBM, yes. And mm-hmm. Shannon was working mm-hmm. for Bell Labs, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe there's a history of deep theory in...
Yes, that's actually an interesting comment. Yeah, I mean, at least in like the foundations of like quantum algorithms, you can really see that a lot of people go to industry. So I would expect, in the coming years, I mean, I don't know if there are any breakthrough results, but like a lot of important work, also in error correction to a certain degree, come out of companies. I do worry though a little bit, right? I don't know how this was in the 40s, 50s, 60s or later. There was probably more like job security than now at these tech companies. You know, things can change very quickly, which then, of course, it's difficult to kind of... because you need like, you know, safety. Long kind of timeline, right? And you need to have safety, you need to have consistency to kind of develop this big ideas. But I guess, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll get to your transition back to academia, but maybe just one very quick question that I thought of was that did you meet in your time at Amazon, did you meet some algorithm specialists from sort of the industry side that work on relevant problems? How many of these people are running around, and do they run into like the quantum department at Amazon?
So you mean other industry
like
teams?
People at Amazon working mm-hmm. on sort of algorithm optimization for like more generic classical stuff, like, you know, optimizations.
Yeah, so at Amazon, the theory, the algorithms is kind of small. So this was just kind of us, if you want. Sometimes we worked with this customer-facing team. So we did like projects for people that would pay for them. Like, probably shouldn't give any names, but... so there were these interactions, and then there were like in California there were lots of kind of like in events where you would meet like other teams like Microsoft or Google, mm-hmm. and then there would be actually there's quite a lot of exchange. So I think overall it's a very kind of friendly field still also in industry around algorithms at least, because it's so everything's so abstract, so people are still willing to share if you want. When it comes to more relevant problems, I don't know, like, I mean, like really problems that people care about in industry.
Yeah, exactly. Like the people who, I don't know, optimize Amazon's optimization algorithms. Like there must be some people there in the basement who just really try to get the most.
Like classical.
Yeah, the classical part.
The classic. Yeah, I mean, we did talk to these people, but the gap between, you know, what they're doing and how good quantum computers are, it's just huge.
Yes.
I mean, you can get some guidance, right? Like, if you look at, you know, often, you know, there's some whatever NP hard problem, right? Like, very problem is we know it's hard in general, but they need to solve it anyway, right?
Yeah.
Because it needs to be solved. So what can you do, right? And then they have very specific instances and methods, and you can take inspiration from that, but it's kind of one way. I don't think quantum can give back a lot because, you know, the devices are just not there yet.
Yeah. But yeah, basically Amazon is probably one of the companies in the world with the most logistics and mm-hmm. and optimization mm-hmm. problems that they are solving on a daily basis, right?
Yes. But again,
it's
quantum doesn't help at this time at all. Like, this is a huge gap, and so there is this in-house all these teams. Actually, I can give you another example. I also talked a lot to like the cryptography teams at Amazon because I was also doing a bit of cryptography. This was my background, original background, partly. And even there, right, they have like very practical problems and they have customers that ask for certain products or they have certain needs. And then there's the question, okay, what can Quantum do better? And does that fit any of these problems or security bottlenecks? Because, you know, maybe you have like a chain and then there are some bottlenecks where things are like least safe, let's say. And if Quantum doesn't fit these bottlenecks, but just makes something that's already safer, it's not really useful application-wise. Right? So it's really difficult, in my opinion, to match. Because Quantum, you know, you can't pick what Quantum is good at. It's just it's good at certain things. But if that matches what people need, yeah, it's difficult.
Then you came back to academia. Was there a reason why you did that?
Yes. So let me start by saying that it was a very kind of close call. It was not like obvious at all to me, like what to do. There are some personal reasons, some financial reasons, and some, I guess, scientific reasons. But okay, so I had this like ERC starting grant from the European Union, and I could like postpone it for a while. But at some point, it was like, okay, you either come back to Europe or like you lose this grant. And if you lose this grant, it's kind of like, okay, you're not serious as an academic. So it's like, okay, either I come back now or, you know, I stay in tech kind of. So there was that kind of, I mean, there were also other grants, but this was this kind of situation. And so that's why I applied, you know, because in London, I knew that it's going to be difficult long term, just, you know, to make a living. UK is a complicated place. And then I applied a couple of places, and of course, yeah, then I got the offer from Aachen and negotiated, and I was kind of like happy with the package. So that's kind of maybe on the scientific side. The other thing was also personal. My long-term partner, she's from Europe. She decided at some point, okay, she's not going to move to the US, also because of incompatibility of medical degrees and stuff like that, right? So this was a very personal thing. So it was kind of... That played into it as well. I will say also that, yeah, financially it was a kind of a hard decision because, I mean, the difference in salaries is so huge, right? Like if you work like 5 to 10 years in tech, you earn more money than all your life long as a German academic, right? So it's like, well, let's just stay 5 more years and then I'm good, right? there were thoughts like that. But in the end, you know, you want a meaningful life, you know, and I much believe in the German academic system. So,
Speaking of the German academic system, you did hit the ground running there, and you immediately went into teaching. Like, if we look into your teaching load, it's not insignificant, right?
No, I'm immediately full teaching load. Yeah. This is I hacked it a little bit in the sense that I arrived like, I don't know, like 1 week after the term starts, so I could avoid at least teaching the very first time. But normally they give you a teaching reduction. This was not foreseen in this case, which is especially for me, right? I do have a degree in physics, but then 20 years I was basically not, you know, I was not much in contact with this, and then, you know, I. Teaching this kind of basic theory lecture in physics, yeah, it still is a challenge okay. Let's say.
But do you also enjoy it? Does it does it inspire you occasionally? I guess there's this Feynman thing of like you only know something if you teach it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I learn or relearn a lot again. That's definitely true. So in that sense, it's also like satisfying. Sometimes it's just there's too much. Right, like I mean, as a professor, I don't even have working hours, right? I just have tasks, but there are just too many tasks, right? and so, yeah, sometimes it's a bit too much, and then the question is, right, what does the university want from me? Like, what should I prioritize? So this I find difficult sometimes, you know, research, funding, teaching, this kind of a thing. Then what's also kind of probably not unique, but especially in Germany, is that you can study for free, right? You can study for very many years also, and so that means you have a lot of students, and it means you will have very good students, best students. I think they're as good as at any of the best schools, but you also have like a lot of let's maybe call them less motivated students, right? And they're part of the lecture as well, so you need to kind of tailor to. And this is something I struggle a bit with sometimes, because I feel like if you study physics, you know, you should keep committed. They're like easier degrees to get if you just want to like somehow get through it. So this I'm still adapting, I guess. But yeah,
just one of the things I think, I mean, I also studied in Aachen, and I always thought that the theory professors who come in and then they, you know, have these 9 blackboards and this big lecture hall, and they, you know, fill all of them twice in a lecture.
Yes.
Like, it's a very specific skill to do this blackboard lecture, right? And it's a skill that has nothing to do with the day-to-day work, as well, not as much to do with the day-to-day work. How was it for you to get into this? Like, do you have to practice?
Yes, I guess every year hopefully gets a bit better. But I mean, it's generally true. If you become a professor, you know, you become a professor because you excelled at science in a very kind of narrow direction. Maybe you were also successful in raising some money, and that's what you get hired for, right? But then you get tasks, and you have, many of them have nothing to do with what you trained for, what you, you know, are educated in. And I think there's a bit of a challenge, yeah. And I think one should also kind of be more aware of that issue. Indeed, I mean, for example, also if you start as a professor, there's okay, I have very nice colleagues that help me with things, but like no, like a priori, no one tells you how to do anything. You just go there, like, oh yeah, this is your office. It's kind of a harsh transition. Yes, yes, indeed. And the teaching specifically, I did teach a lot also when I was at ETH already during my undergrad. To make some money on the side, to like finance, to get my degree. And so, and this was all old school blackboard kind of style. So I have some experience from there, but yeah, I mean, I also get rated, right? The students rate my teaching, right? And yeah, there are certainly areas where can I improve, yeah.
You also take this course on quantum algorithms. You teach the master's students, but that is related to, in some way, to your work. Do you also have to take like bachelor's courses or things that are completely different?
And yes, exactly. So I have this the quantum algorithms lecture, which I designed and from scratch. This is also fewer students, smaller room. So I think, you know, there's more intimate interactions and stuff. So this is easier in some sense. Everyone's interested anyway. They wanted this. They picked this. Then there's the quantum information kind of lecture. It's also a master lecture, but everyone that goes for this quantum technologies degree has to take it. That's something in between, like a bit more students. And then, yeah, they're the bachelor lectures. So they're basically, the way it works in Aachen is all the theoretical physicists, they share this kind of, like there's theory 1, 2, 3, and 4, which is just covering all like for the bachelor stuff. And I'm currently teaching this theory 4, which is statistical physics.
I see.
And this is a challenging part. This is the 9 big blackboards, kind of. Even the organization, like, you know, you get like 15 people, like assistants, Oberassistent, everyone. And it's like a lot of stuff. And again, it's just like, you do it.
But it's like not really more relaxed as people think that, you know, working as compared to working in industry, academia is a bit more relaxed, but not necessarily.
I would say it's 100% the other way around.
Okay.
So this 2 years at Amazon, I was still working on top of the 100% there, 20% in London, Imperial College. I had like a group there and everything, but nevertheless, like, you know, in industry, you work on a project, right? You're part of a project, you know, you have kind of working hours at least, and just do your stuff. If you like lead a research group as a professor, I think there's much more like pressure, like responsible for everything, right? Like, So I guess it depends on the person and the exact job, but I would say working in industry is much, much less stressful than being like, let's say, a competitive professor. Also, I found that many professors, at least in this kind of theory realm, are, you know, people are very smart, right? It's a competition of the best ideas. In tech, there are very smart people, but they're also like, let's say, more normal people. So the competition is kind of different. So I found it quite easy and relaxing to, you know, blend in, let's say, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's true. The professors is a very selective thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of selection, right, to get there, yeah.
Your research group, so you said you got this ERC grant, and so I guess you got more grants because your research group for a theory group that is sort of starting out, started out as a large research group. Like, how many people do you have at the moment?
Well, it depends a bit how you count, right? Like master students, for example. But maybe it's around 15 people, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would say, like, let's say the normal start as a theoretical physics junior professor or something, you would start with maybe a PhD student and the postdoc, but you are starting with this bigger group. Is this, like, I guess this is a management challenge also, not just a scientific one, right?
Yes. I mean, I was already a professor in London for 3 plus 2 years, yeah. The 2 years when I was also working at Amazon. So I have some experience from there. And maybe there are like 5, 6 people at most. But so I had some experience in that sense. But yes, there's a lot of even like the hiring or like, you know, how do you get a work visa in Germany and stuff like that, right? Like,
yeah.
If this one Chinese guy is from Harbin, which is kind of a military school in China, and we got a visa in the end, so it's good. but there are lots of these aspects, and again, I think I'm just kind of growing into it. Maybe I agree that in like at least theoretical physics, people usually have very small groups, but at least in quantum, if you have like a junior professor, they might be happy to hire more people. They just don't necessarily have more funding, right? In my case, yeah, there were a couple of grants. Also, this kind of excellence cluster here at ML4Q is providing quite a bit of funding. And then, of course, it would be a pity not to use it, yeah, in a sense, even if it's a bit stressful, yeah.
So we can talk about your research interest, one of which is quantum information theory and cryptography. Did you hear about quantum computing first or quantum cryptography?
Oh, a good question. As an undergraduate, there was a lecture. I don't know what it was called, but it was taught after this Nielsen and Chuang book, right? It was taught by this Atta Chimamoglu, who is actually an experimentalist. Mm-hmm. That was my first interaction. Okay. I think it was a bit of everything. Yeah, a bit of everything. Yeah. And then Adachi told me that, you know, Renato would be coming to ETH. So I emailed Renato, and this was the story. I didn't necessarily pick, I want to do information theory and not computing. It was just kind of like, okay, that's how things went. That's how I got into it.
So did you then, quickly one also encounters this Shannon canon of information, like classical information theory, because it's very important for cryptography. Did you like study up on that very quickly, or did you have lectures there?
Well, I'm still studying up on it, I guess. That's what my electrical engineering students are also very handy for. There were no lectures, at least at ETH is not really foreseen. I mean, you can take lectures. But I think, okay, so once you start a PhD, you do something like professionally all day long. I think, you know, you just catch up on it on your own, right? Like you have all day long. So you don't, I mean, okay, so lectures can be very good if you have like a good teacher. But for me, I would usually anyway just like learn stuff a bit independent of the actual lecture, you know, you just read a book or some online course, and that's how I would catch up on it. I always found it easier if you start out very mathematical theory and then you want to go more applied, like to go that direction versus the other. So for example, I didn't study math originally, right? So whenever I go more into math, I find it more struggling than going the other way in the more applied direction.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, interviewing you as an experimental physicist, it's not easy to get into all of this. And for example, in this information theory stuff, there's entropy. And as a guy with a physics and education, I have a rough idea of what entropy is. But there's, there's this more quantum version of entropy. And it doesn't really have that much to do with thermodynamics, right? Do you think a lot about this? Does it all become quite obvious how this fits together when you think about it long enough? Or
I think entropy is a very interesting concept, precisely because of what you said, namely that it appears in different scientific disciplines. And this is a priori completely disconnected. You know, this is just kind of a certain mathematical function that pops up. And then, it's the same function. So let's also call it entropy, right? I think there's also this famous story, right? that von Neumann entropy, right, in quantum dynamics was discovered, like, or first talked about, like, maybe in the 30s, 1930s. And then Shannon, you know, he came up with theory of information, but then there was the question how you should call this function. And then von Neumann told him to call it entropy, you know, because it's the same function, right? But very different scientific disciplines. So indeed. And then this makes it very exciting, right? Because then you can ask, okay, is there like a deeper meaning to that? And maybe there is. But I think, like looking at these kind of interdisciplinary questions, I find very exciting. Yeah, indeed. I wouldn't say I understand it all. No,
we have lots of questions, but maybe we can like one of the key things in also quantum communication is entanglement, and you have worked a lot with this. Do you think we are still learning new things about entanglement, and is there like a new sort of discoveries of usage in multipartite systems?
I think we're still learning a lot, at least on a kind of a theory perspective. Even this year, there has been quite a lot of exciting progress, I find. If this translates into, you know, applications, you know, let's say for quantum internet or something like that, this is, of course, a little less clear, let's say, yeah. But no, I mean, short answer is, I think, yeah, there is still a lot of progress, partly because it's so kind of a poorly understood in some sense, once you have multipartite systems. Yeah.
And you have this whole debate about post-quantum cryptography, and I guess some companies are now switching to that. But it's costly, right? Like do you think Schwarz algorithm will be pushed into the NISQ era and there will be some things happening, or is it rather like, I mean, from my experimental point of view, it looks like at least 10 years down the line or something until somebody does anything meaningful. And that's optimistic.
Yes, probably. I mean, okay, so post-quantum cryptography, I want to say that this is mostly classical cryptography.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right? It's not quantum safe. Yes. I mean, you can use also quantum solutions, but they're actually classical solutions kind of that we're happy with. And I mean, this is, even in some of the products they're using, this is, I think, in Chrome also, they used it at some point, like, you know, it works, it's fine. Like,
so sure. Exactly, we don't need quantum.
We don't need quantum, at least.
Internet. We don't need the quantum internet to be safe against Schwarz algorithm.
That's at least our current understanding, of things. So this is, if there's a strong incentive to make this transition, transitions always cost, but I think the technology is basically there if we would want to. Now, sure, and short term, so I'm not sure how well this is understood, but I think generally sure is quite difficult to implement in a noise resistant way, right? There are certain algorithms that are believed maybe are more noise resistant, or noise can even be like made use of in a certain sense. Sure is not necessarily of that type. So I don't expect like any early applications to go in that direction. But maybe the last point to say is that, of course, you know, if you record all the conversations that are happening nowadays, right, you can decrypt them later. Right?
Yeah.
So that maybe gives you some urgency of like, but I mean, changing
that's,
your system.
Yeah, that's milk has already been spilled, let's say. Like,
But that's going to be very interesting, no? Like, if you can listen to all, you know, the worldwide, whatever, central intelligence conversation.
I mean, the story is that NSA somewhere in the desert or somewhere has some data centers where they're basically just sucking up the internet and putting it on hard disks, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, other countries are doing that as well, probably, right?
So, this is, I don't know. This is happening, certainly. Let's switch to algorithms.
Algorithms.
What's your favorite quantum algorithm? Like, softball?
My favorite quantum algorithm. There are the ones that are like very like elegant, let's say, and cool. But recently, I think a very important development has been made around quantum Gibbs samplers. So you want to basically create thermal states of quantum many-body systems. So not the ground state at zero temperature, but at some non-zero temperature. And then the question is how you can do that efficiently or more efficiently, like learn stuff about these Gibbs states. And there's been a lot of progress last year and this year on this question. I think this is currently the most exciting avenue to explore further. Not necessarily because we already know it's very good, it's just it's promising and not explored enough yet. So that's maybe currently my favorite.
Part of your work also involves benchmarking these quantum algorithms. Mm-hmm. How important are classical simulations for this?
Yes, you can benchmark in different ways, right? You can either like run your algorithm actually on a quantum computer. So if you don't do it in a very smart way, you only see noise. I don't know how much you learn. You can run it on a simulator, right, of a quantum computer. And then, of course, you know, classical computations are very important. So these simulations, they would maybe be mostly for like typical use case analysis, right, that you try to simulate. But it's very restricted in the sense that you can only look at very small instance sizes, you know, 20, 30 qubits, something like that. But then, a lot of the benchmarking is more kind of that we also do is more like a resource analysis. Like you don't actually run the algorithm, you just like count how many quantum gates or elementary steps you think you will need and what type of gates. And then that gives you kind of an estimate, if you want to, with this quantum algorithm, solve a problem that is classically hard, that maybe you can't solve classically, it gives you an estimate of like how many gates you need, like how powerful your hardware needs to be. And of course, you also need classical computers, but you don't actually simulate the algorithm, right? You just kind of try to estimate how many gates you would need to actually run it, something like that.
So when you work on these things, do you work on the fully abstract level, or do you think already about gate sets and like compiling the algorithm?
There you can go down the chain as far as you want or you don't want, but what I'm familiar with is the quantum circuit model. So there you count like elementary gates, but then of course people make this distinction between Clifford and non-Clifford gates, and that's basically how far we would go. So there are the type of like easy quantum gates or Clifford gates, and then the non-Clifford gates.
And this is basically due to error correction. Like, I mean, essentially the reason we call Clifford easy is because we think that error correction will be Cliffordian.
So this already makes like a lot of assumptions about your system architecture, indeed. But it doesn't make assumptions about like the concrete way you realize it, right? Just kind of... So then you would count these like non-Clifford gates, and this is usually the number you use. Like, okay, you need like 10 to the 6 of those, and this gives you kind of an estimate on, and of course also how many qubits you need and stuff like that. But indeed, this is how far down the chain I would usually go. This is not necessarily a very near-term relevant, I should add, right? But I think it gives you good pointers, like where you should look for quantum advantage, like realistic quantum advantage, like in the long run. And this is the whole reason, you know, billions are poured into this field. So that's why I think these are useful pointers.
So one of the projects you've been involved with here is this sort of big review article on quantum algorithms. How was it to put together? Like there was originally this website, the Quantum Algorithm Zoo, but you guys are now making it more concrete, writing more details, and you have really a big group of theorists to look into this. How did this come together?
There are, of course, a lot of things I could say about that. But okay, so it started when I was at Amazon. And basically, it started out of very many negative results. Right, because we're told by management, you have to look at good algorithms for quantum advantage, like in practice for problems of relevance, whatever. Okay, so we look at A, B, C, D, and it would actually maybe invest significant time, understand it much better. But then it would always be like, okay, maybe there's some quantum advantage somewhere, but not for like in some sense like this. We call this end-to-end complexity, right? So you have a certain problem that you want to solve in industry or whatever. And then and you have a whole chain of computations, and in the end you want the result. Like it's usually a classical thing, like a number. And then you need to count all the computational resources used in between. And the question is, if you replace some of these resources with some type of quantum versions, does it help, right? And if you make that kind of analysis, let's say, it's very challenging to find good algorithms, good problems for quantum algorithms. And so then we internally started writing these things up, and that's how it started, actually. And then it got bigger and bigger, and the idea was actually originally to have a Wikipedia like kind of thing. And it's different from this Quantum Algorithm Zoo, because the Quantum Algorithm Zoo is it just focuses kind of on this complexity theoretic results for certain subroutines, right? So you have a certain mathematical problem. Okay, you can solve it that well with the quantum algorithms. But this is not in this end-to-end fashion, in the sense that, okay, so down this chain of computations, maybe you have some subroutine for which quantum is good, but you know, you don't look at it holistically. For example, this quantum algorithm also only looks at it in terms of computational cost. But, you know, a computer is not only the CPU, right? You have like maybe GPU, then you have maybe quantum version, you have RAM, you have quantum RAM. Like, you have to look at all the resources. So that's kind of what we're trying to do in this review article. First on the kind of primitives, and then on really the application side. But yeah, it was, once I left Amazon, I was no longer in charge. I mean, first I was in charge, but then I left, and so other people took over. I was still part of the team, of course. But yeah, it was a mess, as you can imagine, right? And also the next difficulty is that, you know, new results come out all the time.
Yeah.
So you have to do like a cutoff at some point. And but I think it's a very, very valuable resource, and the hope or the goal of this is to kind of guide maybe the broader scientific community, especially in industry also, to work on the right type of problem that really promise like long-term progress.
So it's written not only for physicists, but also for people who are just more generally interested in algorithms.
I mean, it's a technical document, so it's in that sense for specialists. But, you know, you have like a gazillion of startups. They work on like algorithms, you know, for people like that, maybe like, yeah. Okay, don't work on these. There's no long-term promise. Like, look at these problems. These are usually hard problems, but if you tell people explicitly, like, okay, look, this is not leading anywhere. Look at this instead. I think this can be a good, very good service for the community. Yeah.
You mentioned that new things keep coming up. So this year also has been really great in terms of hardware development in quantum mm-hmm. computing and things like that. So could you comment on complexity versus scalability for today's architecture? And what's sort of your prediction for the skeptics?
Yes, I mean, okay, so I think you recently also had Markus Müller, right, on this podcast, so you should probably ask him about the hardware breakthroughs and the scalability of those.
But in terms of like applying quantum algorithms to now
the devices, yes. We barely have one logical qubit, right, and we can't do any computations on it. So in that sense, we can't do any logical computation at all yet. Right. So, but okay, that's not necessarily the message I want to give. It's kind of hard to say because there are also these competing technologies, right? And then I think certain technologies have, they can go to point X, but maybe not further unless you have an additional scientific breakthrough. I think this is kind of an interesting way of measuring it. Like these people that develop hardware, like, do they believe with their current ideas and technologies, like, how far can they push it? And how far they think they cannot push it, because, you know, then some other effect pops up and you need to fundamentally do things differently. And I think right now with these ideas, you can still push considerably, which is a very nice. But there's still a huge gap, right, like between actual hardware and what the complexity theorists talk about. And then, the question is also, do you want to do a quantum computation that is classically hard, that you cannot do on a classical device? Because then...
Yeah.
We're talking far future, or are you just happy to do some logical computations, like some proof of principles? This might be sooner-ish. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of algorithms that are sort of sub-exponential, mm-hmm. but related to like generic linear algebra problems, because mm-hmm. there's a link between quantum mechanics and linear algebra.
Mm-hmm.
From doing the review of all the algorithms, is there things that stick out to you? Do you think there's potential there?
Yeah, this is kind of an involved question, I guess, because there's a lot of like different type let's say quantum linear algebra type of algorithm. But I will say that I think it's very challenging to find significant quantum speed up compared to like state-of-the-art classical methods, both in terms of like theory and asymptotic complexities, as well as in terms of actual, you know, finite size relevant instances kind of performance. The thing is just because of the error correction overhead, right? You need large quantum advantages for them to become relevant in any reasonable kind of time frame. And this is very challenging. I think there is this kind of wisdom out there in the community that you need at least kind of a super quadratic speed up. Like this is kind of the threshold in the sense that quadratic is on the one hand relatively generically available. But on the other hand, also that really a quadratic does not seem enough. So if you have a quartic speed up or something, you might already be happy. But even that is very rare. And usually if people find something like that, then it's also because it's such a contrived problem and instance that, you know, classical algorithms have not been sufficiently looked at for that problem. So it's actually quite cool sometimes, right? Like, you know, you find a quantum algorithm and people find a classical one. And I mean, there's good progress. But the pattern I see is that, you know, people, you know, they make good proposals like, oh yeah, I look at that linear algebra problem, right? Like linear system solver or something like that. People are excited. A lot of smart people look into the problem a lot. But then we learn a lot about it. But often the message is like, okay, actually quantum, you know, small speed up, but not that useful. So sometimes a bit the pattern.
Yeah. And sometimes people have even discovered that the sort of quantum speed up can be implemented completely classically as well.
That can also happen. Yeah, yeah. I think scientifically, again, this is a great adventure. We learn a lot, right? It's very productive.
Yes.
It's also one of the reasons why academia is maybe a good place to be in that sense, because if you work in industry, ultimately they want you to find this holy grail applications.
Yes, yes. I mean, especially these big tech companies, right? They're known for, you know, pouring tens of billions into something, and then one day to another, they're like, oh, you know, now we don't feel like it anymore. So that can happen, yes. I do feel, though, that, you know, in academia, you know, it's taxpayers' money in the end. So we need to, like, really justify what we're doing versus in industry, you know. Some shareholders then lost this money, then I care less, yeah.
Maybe we can also just build in this quick disclaimer about NP hard problems and so on, and traveling salesmen, like, I don't know what you think about this, but there's sort of still, even though there's very little evidence, people are still saying, you know, quantum computing will solve logistical challenges and so on. And it's...
Yeah, I mean, there's like the wisdom that, yeah, probably we can't find like, how can I phrase it as precisely as possible, like super polynomial quantum speed ups for NP hard problems. I think people don't think that this is the case. So there is no like one for all solution. If your optimization problem has a very specific structure, maybe, you know, maybe quantum computers are good. It's just that, you know, if you simulate physical systems, then, you know, you have certain structure and maybe quantum is amenable to that. But if you just look at them, kind of general linear algebra problem, general optimization problem, right? Like it might have had nothing to do with quantum at first. Maybe it still has good structure for quantum, but you have to work on that. You cannot just say like, oh, it's going to be good. Like you really, you have to tell me why, right? It's not enough to just have this kind of wishful thinking here.
So, okay. We can talk a little about the mathematics of quantum information. So first of all, do you think there is such a thing as an atomic unit of information?
Yes, yes. I mean, there's the unit of information, which is in classical physics, right? It's a bit, and in quantum, it's a qubit. So in that sense, there is such a unit. But of course, one of the interesting findings of quantum is that this unit depends on the underlying physics, right? So Shannon's idea was that you can kind of define information independent of its physical representation. Right? Mm-hmm. But this was implicitly also assuming that it's independent of the physical theory behind it. But now with nowadays knowledge, we know that, okay, it's actually not independent of the physics. So whatever physics you take, you can define this unit of information there. I'm not sure what other... philosophical implications come with that word. The interesting part is that the quantum unit of information is fundamentally different than the classical one in many aspects. Yeah,
we have quantum mechanics, and it's sort of this generalization of probability theory.
Mm-hmm.
But like when quantum mechanics was discovered, the math for it was sort of to a large extent there. Do you think we are now I mean, in this whole pushing for mathematical quantum information, we are discovering some of the properties of this math, but sort of the framework, complex numbers, linear algebra, it was all sort of readily available, right? And we're now moving around in it. What is your feeling for this?
Yes. I mean, okay. So back then, I think there are objects called like von Neumann algebras, right? Yeah. They were introduced by von Neumann partly because of quantum theory. So some math, at least in this very general abstract sense, was developed also because of the discovery of quantum mechanics. And okay, but then given that, it's true that we mostly work within the framework, just the mathematical rules of quantum mechanics, right? We explore those. Maybe we understand more aspects of it or more consequences, but we rarely go outside, maybe. But there was in the, already a couple of years ago now, right? But there was this interesting result, right? I'm not sure if this is published by now, probably still not, but that this in operator algebra theory, right? That this con embedding conjecture, whatever, is wrong. And this was work out of quantum information, so to speak. So I think there is kind of a back action also to mathematics again. And for example, also the mathematical physics community, like the old school mathematical physics community, they are very interested in quantum information. So it's interdisciplinary in that sense. And it also goes both ways, I would say, yeah.
You actually work in a way that's very close to mathematics with lemmas and theorems. What do people who look at quantum mechanics this way see that others might miss?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, usually, right, like there's a whole spectrum of physicists, you know, experimentalists and more like applied hands-on physicists, and then you get more theory and mathematics, and then what people always joke, right, is like, if you're really a mathematical physicist, you know, everyone already knows how it works, but then in the very end, you know, the mathematical physicist can also prove it, right? So what did you actually learn from that? I mean, it's a good question you might ask in certain settings, right? Like, for example, people try to like prove that atoms are stable. Like, if you want to prove that rigorously from first principles, you can only do it for like, I don't know, maybe like very small atoms and molecules. You can do stuff like that. You can ask, okay, what do you actually learn? Of course, you learn like maybe mathematical things. But I think when you talk more about these foundational aspects and like what is the very core of information, what are kind of the ultimate limits of information processing, you can really, you know, gain some insights by, you know, fully formalizing things. And often what also happens is that, you know, maybe physicists come up with some ideas, some conjecture. They see certain phenomena for certain systems. But then, you know, you want to put this in a whole like framework and, you know, prove things as general as you can. I think you bring in a lot of structure to the situation, to the knowledge. But it is true that it's more on the rare side, you know, that new physics would be discovered because of mathematical prediction. There are examples, but, you know, often it goes the other way. I acknowledge that.
Yes. We are running towards the end of the podcast, but we can maybe just very quickly, because there's like, we wanted to give an example, like there's this Stein's lemma, and there has been a lot of recent debate, and you wrote a comment, I believe, on it.
Mm-hmm.
So can we just very quickly tell this story, and maybe on the one hand it's mathematical, but on the other hand it's also related to many concrete problems, right?
Yes. So there was many years ago, I guess, like 15 years ago or so, there has been this kind of well-known result on entanglement testing, which is called this like quantum Stein's lemma. But okay, so the reason people are very interested in that, it's around the question if like entanglement transformations are reversible. So if you have, you know, a certain state, maybe maximum entangled, and another one, maybe less entangled, like when can you convert one state to another and back? This is like kind of the general framework. And it has this connection to quantum hypothesis testing, to quantum statistics. And this goes under this name, Stein's lemma. But okay, so it's about understanding entanglement. And so anyway, there was this series of papers in Communication in Mathematical Physics, which is kind of a very prestigious journal in mathematical physics. Multiple papers in Nature Physics also, which obviously is a high-impact journal. But then these papers are very difficult to understand, and I think very few people even tried, including myself. Actually, I spent like maybe 2 years in London with a postdoc trying to understand some of these things, and we couldn't see the proof. Okay, this was just out there, but people were using these results all the time, right? These kind of mathematical people were using them. And then at some point, there was another group that wrote like a follow-up paper on the original works that used these original results in a certain way. And then we went through this follow-up work, and this just seemed to be wrong. Like the implications seemed to be too strong. And then we went back, basically. And then, yeah, one day I got up in like California, and my collaborator, like Marco Tomomichl in Singapore, he had this like counterexample to the proof, and then everything kind of fell apart. So the papers they're just like, the proofs are wrong, right? So the argument was wrong. And this was kind of a big thing, yeah, in the community. And lots of interesting things happened. Like also, like what do the journals do, right? What do the editors mm-hmm. do of these papers that are peer-reviewed, you know, the peer-review stamp on there? And then what happens, right? There were like important people on these papers. And, yeah. Anyway, then, yeah, there were a couple of papers written. We wrote a note also in comment in Nature Physics about the situation. But then, yeah, luckily, this year, actually, there are two solutions to the original problem that appeared that seem to be correct. So it's fixed now.
So fewer, exactly. Yeah. The lemma stands. The original proof yes. didn't.
The original proof didn't. Yes, exactly. And it's a very also socially interesting situation, right? You can kind of question the whole publication, peer review system. And because what often happens is actually papers are slightly wrong, but it's always fixable. And then people always like, oh, yeah, okay, I know this is wrong, but, you know, we can do it a bit differently. But in this case, it wasn't, right? So this is why it had big implications for once. It was a nice communication in the sense that people were open about it, and it ultimately led to good scientific progress. So in that sense, it's a happy end, at least for science. but yeah, I think... there are lots of questions that one should ask, right? Like, okay, how were all these papers peer-reviewed and no one noticed the mistake? It's kind of a simple mistake, you know, if one...
Yeah, I mean, we have this in experimental physics as well, that, you know, there was lots of scandals recently also in the quantum information field. And, I mean, there it was much more serious. It was not mistakes, but even, you know, problematic practices, let's say. Maybe not fraud, but... you know, at least problematic mm-hmm. practices in the science. And I think the problem is peer review, you know, in the end, somebody gets a paper and maybe has a week to spend on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a complicated mathematical proof, maybe you would need a month or...
Yeah, yeah. So this is actually also a problem because the field is so interdisciplinary, right? Because, for example, in math or mathematical physics, it's not uncommon to have 12 months time to review a paper. You get 12 months, like a year. Like this is normal because you need the time, right? Yeah. You want to invest mm-hmm. the time. And of course now everything is mingled and you have these math papers and people anyway don't review them. And yeah, so it's challenging. Of course, it's a bigger question about the whole publication system, but I think it's interesting. And all the original papers are wrong. They're still online. Huh? So yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
take from that whatever you want.
I mean, another problem... Indeed, that's the problem. I mean, the journals are very slow to... like, even if you want to fix your own work, I mean, if you want to ask, can we please, you know, change these this formula? We made some typo. Mm-hmm. It takes a while, right? Like, these journals are not fast by any... like.
Some even don't do it. So I have other papers. I know they're wrong. We have counterexamples. I'm like, okay, we made a mistake. I want to retract it. They say, no, addendum erratum impossible. Sorry.
Yeah.
So there's really... this is not... something that was thought about properly and then something reasonable was implemented. I also don't have like immediate solutions, but I think it's something we could think about also as a community.
Yeah.
So before we come to the end, I just mm-hmm. also want to, since you have joined recently at Alveteha as a professor mm-hmm. and you're growing your group, do you have any positions you'd like to advertise? Or
we have open positions at any level. I mean, like, bachelor, master, PhD, or postdoc. it has to fit, of course. I think I also have a call on my homepage, but I encourage people to send me their documents, and I would get back to them if I think I see a good fit for interview. Yeah, that would be great, of course. Yeah. So always looking for people. Thank you.
So Mario, thanks a lot for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you guys. Yeah, it was very nice.